Here in Australia, it's an understatement to say we've seen a huge amount of controversy over coal seam gas, fears about poisoning land and water, flames erupting from the kitchen tap, not to mention perhaps the bigger issue of why we'd produce any more fossil fuels, given the planet has allegedly some heating problems. In the US, louder even than here, protests over fracking or hydraulic fracturing, and has even been banned in some states. But despite that, it is a fascinating truth that fracking has increased the supply of domestic oil and natural gas in the US by orders of magnitude. And it seems the US is now the world's biggest oil and gas producer. That's happened in a pretty short space of time. One of my next guests is a rare voice from within the fossil fuel industry. And he argues some interesting pro-fracking, or certainly pro-gas points of view. He's written a book which tries to extend the conversation beyond the usual polarities. Gary Cernovitz is the MD of an oil and gas industry-focused private equity firm called Lime Rock Partners, and he's also the author of the book The Green and the Black, the complete story of the shale revolution and the fight over fracking and the future of energy. And Gary, thanks for joining us from New York. Sitting with me in the studio is Tim Flannery, who has the heavy burden of being Australia's most famous environmentalist. He's the head of the privately funded Climate Council, after the Climate Commission was axed by Abbott. And I'm pleased to report that it's going very nicely. Thank you very much, Tony. Tony Abbott will be irritated to hear this. Tim's written a very interesting review of Gary's book in, yes, the current New York Review, positive in parts, but critical as well. Is that fair, Tim?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I found Gary's book immensely entertaining beyond anything else, and very informative. But it has its biases, I think, and it's fair to say as well that the fracking industry and the energy industry as a whole is moving so quickly that even though this is a newly published book, a huge amount's happened since it hit the shelves, and that changes the picture considerably.
Hello, Gary. It's good to have you on the program. You describe a situation where a technology is absolutely transformational. You talk about it reshaping the economy, the environment, energy, balance of power, and the world. Is that not an overreach?
I don't think so at all. I mean, the interesting in your news segment with Peabody Energy going bankrupt today, you know, a big Australian coal miner, but also a U.S. coal miner, and that was a direct function of fracking and sort of the huge surplus of natural gas. About half the natural gas in the United States now comes from, you know, fracked shale gas wells. It's driven down the price, increased the supply, and has a huge environmental impact, economic impact, and you can make similar kind of conclusions on the oil side as well, that really every kind of basic assumption we have about, you know, the use of fossil fuels, sort of the balance of power with energy, and the cost of those fossil fuels has really been transformed over the last 7 or 8 years because of a pretty pedestrian advancements in some, you know, some pretty old techniques of how we get oil and gas out of the ground.
Now, we've got a bit of time to discuss matters arising. Tim, is it transformational or is it a bit of an illusion? Is it a passing fad?
Well, the first thing I think that Gary's book makes clear is that fracking really is an American phenomenon. You know, the Chinese have huge amounts of shale. They've been desperately trying to frack it with very little success. In Australia, we've seen fracking effectively fail over the last 12 months or so, and the company's walking away from it because the shale itself isn't of the correct type to be able to frack easily.
And that's the case in China, or plus
absolutely,
great
yeah.
depth.
It's very deep. It's got a lot of clay in it. It's just not amenable to the technologies that are being used in the US to unlock the gas.
But in the US, there's a bountiful amount of appropriate shale.
Well, there is, although as Gary makes clear that, you know, 20% or so of the shale areas, maybe 30%, are very productive. The rest are less productive than initially thought. And looking at the industry now, you'd have to say that it's heading in the wrong direction to be a miracle cure for the American economy for the next decade at least.
Gary, take us through the history of fracking. When did it start?
It started, the most seminal moment was in 1998, which was a well drilled north of Dallas in Texas by a company called Mitchell Energy. And that was after about 17 years of trial and error experimentation. And the one thing I kind of tried to make clear in the book is, fracking is a bit like the iPhone in the sense that, Apple didn't invent the telephone, didn't invent computers, didn't invent, mobile technology, but it kind of brought all these together in sort of a revolutionary way. And that's what happened in North Texas in this first well in 1998, where people had been fracking, which is, kind of pumping water in high speeds and then some sand or ceramic proppants after it, since just after World War II. And they've been drilling directional wells, like the horizontal wells that people have heard about, even before then. And so what happened is just sort of adjusting the, kind of the recipes, adjusting the techniques. And that happened in 1998. And then it took, 6 or 7 years for that to be realized that this was not just a localized phenomenon in Texas, but kind of then spread across the United States, first on the natural gas side and then on the oil side.
You point out, Gary, that over the last 100 years, acid, nitroglycerine, napalm, even nuclear weapons were all used at various times to try and get at recalcitrant oil. So fracking has a prehistory.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the, issues that kind of frustrates a bit the oil and gas business is that that the recovery of oil and gas this is one of many techniques, actually probably a more benign one than definitely more benign than nuclear weapons, and that it's sort of reached a level of controversy in the United States primarily because it led to people extracting oil and gas in areas that had not been done in 100, 150 years. I'm in New York City. There's now, fracked wells 150 miles from here, and, that hadn't happened. Pennsylvania was the birthplace of the modern oil business in the 1860s, and so, you're talking, generation upon generation before people in New York City thought about this had anything to do with our backyard. And so the thing that I think caught the industry by surprise, and there was definitely some ham-handed reactions to it, was, a pretty, obviously revolutionary impact, but what's going on in the field was never anything thought of as particularly radically new.
Tim, as you know, Gary's book points out that fracking has certainly been a huge problem for the coal industry. Shouldn't we be deeply, profoundly grateful for that?
I don't think so, no. If you're looking towards fracking or coal seam gas as a solution to the climate change problem, a recent study published in October 2014 in Nature shows that it's just not the case, that in fact, the best case scenario for fracking is that it might reduce our emissions by 2% by 2050, which is not where we need to go. We need to be reduced by 100% by 2050. So the real solution to the climate problem and the real energy story, I think, for the future is going to be in clean tech. It's going to be in solar and wind. They're the technologies that are just booming globally. They're not dependent on a specific geology. They don't emit any emissions, and they don't have unintended consequences, as fracking clearly has. I mean, it's redrawn the earthquake map, for example, of North America. There are consequences in this technology that do have to be taken seriously.
Gary, what are some of the dangers that you acknowledge? This earthquake frisson seems to be one of them.
Yeah, I think, I wanted to respond to one. I'll answer the question, but I wanted to respond, one, to a thing Tim had mentioned. But the earthquakes are, not actually from fracking, but from the disposal of wastewater that's happening in a very localized area in Oklahoma. And these are earthquakes that are kind of equivalent for the most part to kind of trucks rumbling by the home. And there have been a few larger ones. But, this is a very solvable problem. The Oklahoma regulators have put in new practices over the last few months, and I think the industry, there are definitely some very stereotypical old school industry people who reject those regulations, but for the most part the industry is abiding by them. So the idea that this is sort of a fatal flaw to the entire kind of fracking process just is not is just not the case. And I think on the issue of is gas displacing coal a good, you know, I think there's no question in my mind that it is one of the essential tools for kind of fighting climate change. You know, the U.S. has led the reduction on absolute terms in carbon emissions over the last 7 or 8 years. It's down another 2% preliminary data in 2015. And that's all attributable to gas displacing coal. China, coal consumption and burning emits more CO2 than the entire United States. And I think Australia, LNG exports from coal seam gas, from fracking potentially, but also just from the Northwest Shelf, plays an essential world-saving role, I think, in getting Australian gas up to China. Because, you know, and I completely understand that the argument that fossil fuels, we have to phase out over the next 30 or 40 years, but the idea that we should not abide or kind of not support a thing in the near term that's going to do, you know, measurable impacts because it gets in the way of a long-term shift away from fossil fuels seems, you know, kind of being an enemy of the good and the desire for the perfect.
Tim, I see your frown is deepening.
Yeah, well it is a bit. I think that, you know, if you look at the figures on investment in the energy sector, you know, fossil fuels are now, you know, half of the investment. Renewables are the other half. So they are growing enormously quickly. Even in the US, in a place like Texas that traditionally has been so heavily dependent on oil and gas, you know, nearly 10% of electricity now comes from wind. You know, they're building lots and lots of solar as well. You look at California, you know, with solar. This is not something that's going to be there in 10 years' time. It's there now. And for gas, really, as Gary says, you know, the main area of economic expansion for gas is into the electricity generation sector. That's just where wind and solar is building too. I don't think you can say that gas is the sole reason for the decline of coal in the US. There's been a whole series of things happening from, you know, from energy efficiency through to more wind and solar through to the fracking boom that have all had an impact.
Okay, Gary, back to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just a statistic, you know, renewables generate 3% of the primary energy in the United States, about 2.5% in the world. So, and I think when you look at the statistics of electricity generation in the United States over the fracking boom, coal has, you know, gone down from 50% to now about a third. Gas went from 15% up to, it's now overtaken coal. So, you know, I think the statistics are very clear that the displacement really is due to gas. But I also think that, you know, one area that I, you know, like to talk about is wind and solar have intermittency issues, that the wind doesn't always blow. Solar is not, the sun is obviously not shining for most of the day. Gas-fired power plants can play a very important role, and they're easy to kind of fire up and down in periods where wind and solar. So, you know, I think when you look at the complementary nature of gas with wind and solar, you know, these aren't the enemy, and I just get a sense that, you know, from the Obama administration to early environmentalists 4 or 5 years ago saying gas could play a very important role in kind of getting us from, you know, to, you know, really what we are is 3% of primary energy to higher.
Tim, it's
become sort of verboten.
Gary's mentioned Obama. What's your thoughts on Obama's record on this? The fracking boom was in its infancy when he first took office.
Well, that's right. Look, and I'm not close enough to the issue to know how much policy has influenced the fracking boom, but it seems to me, you know, just reading Gary's book, that the key factors is, one, technological innovation. There was a little bit of that. There was also a very high oil price, and there was a lot of capital sloshing around before 2008 looking for a home, and it was reasonably patient capital. So those factors really seem to have produced the boom, whatever, you know, the federal government was doing in terms of policy. And they're not repeatable. That's not what we've got now, you know. In fact, I'd be very interested to get an update on Gary about where fracking is now, you know, and particularly what's happened to Aubrey McLennan and others. Is that reflective of what's happened to the industry?
Now, that's a mysterious utterance, and I think you've got to clarify this burning Ferrari.
Well, I think Gary could do a better job of that than I can, but I know, again, from reading your book, Gary, that Aubrey was a huge figure in the fracking boom, and death last month seems to have been under somewhat mysterious circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, clearly it was, you know, he was under great financial distress. You know, he drove a car into a highway overpass at 80 miles an hour without braking. You know, there's a lot of, you know, kind of speculation on why that was. And, you know, and I think most people conclude the obvious, you know, issue of kind of one way to deal with the financial distress.
Fracking is bad for Ferraris, but... I want to look at other downsides of fracking, if you don't mind, Gary. Yeah. And one of them, Tim, was that was that incident, that terrible leak in California.
Well, that's right. That was just earlier this year, a case where an old oil reservoir, a natural oil reservoir in the rock, was being used to store natural gas, as I understand it, and it started leaking. And of course, you know, the Earth isn't a purpose-made vessel for holding gas or anything else. And that leak proved to be very, very difficult to seal. In fact, I think it must have the ran for about 3 months, if I'm right, Gary, and was responsible for about a third of California's greenhouse gas emissions over that time.
Yep. One, just to clarify, I mean, that had nothing to do with sort of the shale revolution or fracking per se. I mean, there is no real shale gas in California. And there's a lot of natural gas in Australia and the United States that comes from a lot of sources. And I think fracking has become sort of the catch-all for fossil fuels and kind of the complications and accidents thereof. But just one clarifying point, that is gas storage. It leaked. It was horrible, but really has nothing to do with whether that gas came from shale wells or anywhere else. It's a mistake that happened in related to gas overall.
Tim, Gary mentions in the book the oil industry sees renewables like solar, like wind, as liberal charity cases.
Yeah, well, that's the point when I thought, wow, I realise the book hasn't mentioned anything about battery technology, which is changing so quickly, or the massive penetration now of wind and solar into the energy market. Sure, it's only 3%, but it is growing at a huge rate. And places like China, it's growing enormously. And Gary, you might be interested to learn that here in Australia, just in terms of rooftop solar, and we've got 1.5 million installations. About one in five Australians now has rooftop solar PV, a far higher rate than in the US.
Yeah, but you've got to admit the sun goes out at night.
Yeah, it does, but that's a lot of electricity.
Look out the window now.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's why battery technology is probably going to be important into the future.
Are there anything you two agree on this issue? No, seriously.
Well,
because
look, there's one thing.
You were also complimentary about the book in your review.
I was. Look, could I say I think it's really important, Philip, for your audience to understand the sort of fracking that Gary's talking about is not principally what's happening in Australia. We don't frack our shales here to any great extent. Instead, and Gary may be interested in this, what we have is a massive industry based on coal seam methane extraction. And in Australia, the coal seams are often the water reservoir for farmers, they're the underground water supply, as well as the seam that the industry is tapping into to dewater that coal and then extract the methane. So for us in Australia, the water issue is a very, very real issue. It's not the same sort of issue that you see in the US.
Gary, I'm going to give you a chance to have the final word.
Well, I appreciate the out of town team advantage at the last at bat. I think, you know, Tim and I, you know, I think do, you know, strongly agree that over the next 30 or, you know, next some period of time, we have to, you know, decarbon the source of energy, and we have to, you know, increase renewables, have to, you know, and have to fight very aggressively and very urgently the emissions of carbon and methane into the atmosphere. I think probably where we disagree is I think, you know, as long as we are using oil and gas, we should, you know, promote gas to displace coal and use oil and gas from countries that are safer, that are more politically benign, and be very aware of pricing of oil and gas without fracking is going to skyrocket 3 or 4 times. So I don't think we have a difference on the endpoint. I don't think we have a difference on the goal. The difference is how do you, in an imperfect sort of tragic energy world, how do you get from here to there is an area where people can disagree.
Gary, thank you very much. Gary Cernovitz, author of The Green and the Black, the complete story of the shale revolution, the fight over fracking and the future of energy, and Tim Flannery, head of the Climate Council. In the few seconds we have left, Tim, I want you just to tell me the good news about your outfit growing. despite the fact that Abbott closed you down.
Well, we now employ 15 very bright, very enthusiastic young people. When I was climate commissioner, I had a team of six. So we're doing even
so
better.
So being savaged by the Abbott government was good for you?
It seemed to have been, yeah, yeah. And it's great. We, you know, the supporter base we have is just fabulous. I've just come away from a supporter event this evening, and it was just, it's full of enthusiastic, wonderful supporters who appreciate the work we're doing. And I think we are making a difference, slowly.
Good on you. Thanks. Thanks again, Gary, and thank you, Tim. This is Ali Nell on RN, and as promised, Ian Buruma, and he's got a really sweet, sad story to tell.